start with something from the Zos HaBracha and connect it in to something from Hazinu also. Two things from Hazinu that we didn't have a chance to get to last week. The last eight psukim in the Torah are difficult and unique, insofar that they speak about the death of Moshe Rabbeinu. The last eight psukim start from Vayomer Shom Moshe Eved Hashem, Vayikbor Oso Begai. Now the question is, who wrote those psukim? The Gemara says, how is it possible that Moshe is dead and he's writing these psukim? And therefore, one opinion in the Gemara says that Yehoshua wrote these last eight psukim. Api Hashem, Avadei, that the Rabbanu Shel Olam dictated these psukim to Yehoshua. Whether he dictated them with the same prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu for these eight psukim or not is not clear. But these psukim are no less part of the Torah than anything else. But since they are different, insofar that they were not written by Moshe Rabbeinu, but they were written by Yehoshua, and probably with a lesser degree of nevuah, therefore these eight psukim are special insofar that you can't split them into two aliyahs. One person has to read all eight. And in fact, in Simchas Torah, this is part of the last aliyah, from a little bit before this, but it's always read by the same person. Same aliyah. The other opinion says, no, how could it be possible that the Torah, the Sefer Torah should be missing something that Moshe Rabbeinu did not write, that was not given with the full nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu pe'al pe'? And therefore, the rest of the Torah, the Rabbanu Shalom dictated to Moshe Rabbeinu, and he wrote it. And this, HaKadosh Baruch Hu dictated, U'Moshe Kosei B'dema. He wrote it with tears. Now, one meaning is that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote this prophetically. God dictated to him, just like other things in the Torah speak about the future. So God dictated what was going to be in the very next few hours or whatever, whenever it was written, the last day of his life. And Moshe wrote it crying, knowing that this records his death. He wrote his own obituary. Another opinion is that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't write it, couldn't write what didn't happen yet. God prophesied what could be in the future. But to write it as if it happened, how can you write in the Sefer Torah what didn't happen yet? So therefore there's another opinion. Moshe wrote it in tears. He didn't write it in ink. He wrote it in tears. It wasn't yet really recorded, but it was recorded in tears. You could see what it was, and after he died, Yehoshua filled it in with ink. The third opinion is the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon, and this is the one I really want to speak about because it ties in with two other things in Hazinu. The Vilna Gaon says, the Ramban says in his Hakdama to the Torah that the Torah preceded the world. Torah was created before the world was created. The Rabbanu Shel Olam used the Torah as the blueprint for the world. Now, you can't understand that literally, that the Torah existed the way we have it before the world was created, because then everything was predetermined. What Paro would say and what Adam would do, it was all there. So when did they have free choice to do it? The script was already written before it ever happened. So if the script was already written, then everything had to be. You can answer that God knew something before it happens. It doesn't have to happen like that. There's still free choice. Because God, when the Rabbanu Shel Olam knows something, he doesn't know it before it happens. He knows it in the all-present future. There is no present future or all-present present. There's no future. There's no past. There is no present. But there's no time by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the whole idea of God knowing something before it happens doesn't apply. It's only in our terms. In God's kind of knowledge and in God's time, the question doesn't start. It's only a question based on if we would know something before it happened, either we knew it and it had to happen like that, or we didn't know if it didn't have to happen like that. Both things can't be true. It can't be that it doesn't have to happen like that and still we know. I see from your eyes that you have no idea what I'm talking about. So let me make it a little bit clearer. I didn't plan to go into this, but there's a very, very fundamental question on two emunos that we have that seem to be contradictory. We believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows everything. There is nothing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't know. He's omnipotent. And yet we believe we have free choice. Now, if you think about it, those two things can't go together. If God knew before I was born, before there was any time, before there was a world, what I was going to be doing now, right, at 6:55, it's 5:55. People don't change clocks. Okay. At 5:55, right, was I going to be sitting in front of you in Michlava, giving you a class? Or was I going to be robbing Bank Mizrahi in Geula? Okay? That's two of our choice. I could have decided not to come today and rob the bank. Okay? It's my free choice. Now, God knew one of them. He knew either I was going to be here or I was going to be robbing the bank. Now, if he knew that I was going to be here, then I don't have a choice to go rob the bank. And if I do have a choice to go rob the bank, then God didn't know what I was going to be. Manafshach. What are you going to say? God knew what I would choose. When did I choose it then? If he knew it before I ever made the choice, when did I have the right to make the choice? So some say, well, God knows it like an astrologer, an astronomer. An astronomer can tell you exactly when a solar eclipse is going to be. He doesn't control it, but he knows. But that's absurd, because God doesn't know like an observer. God's knowledge is absolute. It's possible that the astronomer could be wrong. But God can't be wrong. And therefore, if God knew I was going to be sitting here giving you a class, then I don't have the bechira to go rob the bank. And if I could change and go rob the bank, then God didn't know. The answer to that question, the Rambam says, is there is no answer. It is impossible to know an answer to that question. But we can understand why it's impossible. I'll give you a marshal that the Telz Rosh Hashiva gives in Shirei Das. Imagine a person who has no concept of mirrors. He doesn't understand mirrors. He has a mental block to having mirrors explained to him. And he has no sense of touch. And he has no sense of depth. He sees everything in two dimensions. He doesn't see anything three-dimensional. He has those three problems. You put two candles on a table with a mirror behind it, and you say there's a mitzvah to believe that there are two candles on the table. What does he see? Four candles. He sees the reflection of the two candles in the mirror. So you tell, he says, there's two candles. I see four. So you tell him, no, there's a mirror. He has a mental block to mirrors. There's no way for him to understand what a mirror is. So it's impossible to explain. So, well, touch them. You can see. These you can feel. These you can't. He has no sense of touch. Tell him, well, look, these are three-dimensional. These are only two-dimensional. He has no sense of depth. They will all look two-dimensional. There is no way, based on that person's limitations, to explain to him how it could say there are two candles and he sees four. Now, give him an operation. Take away his mental block to mirrors. Give him the sense of touch and the sense of depth. There's nothing simpler. There's two candles, there's a mirror. What could be simpler? But according to his limitations before that, there was no way of explaining to him how there's no contradiction between what it says on the paper and what he sees. We are in that same situation. We have an understanding of knowledge, especially foreknowledge, knowing something before it happens, that something exists now in the present, and I want to know what's going to be in the future. The future isn't now, it's later. So if I know what's going to be in the future, for sure, then it has to happen. Because if it doesn't have to happen, I don't know. So I can't know And it also doesn't have to happen. Either one is true. Both can't be true. But that's only according to my understanding of knowledge. And I am transferring that to God. Well, if God knows what's going to be in the future, either it has to happen, or if it doesn't have to happen, then he doesn't know. But God doesn't know like that. There is no future by God. There's no past. There's no present. There's no time. So God doesn't know something before it happens. He knows it in a way that we can't even describe. We can't understand no time. And God's knowledge isn't he knows something without him. He is the knowledge of everything. So we're talking about things that we can't even describe. So if we would have those extra senses and know what kind of knowledge God has and how there could be no time, there's no question. You could know something and it doesn't have to happen. There's no contradiction at all. It's only a contradiction within our limited perspective, our limited parameters. Okay, now makes a little bit more sense? Okay. That's why I think in the Animamins, right, there's 13 Animamins. We don't bring any psukim except for one of them. Right? The belief in God, there's no psukim, just Animamin. Right? Shaboris Barashimu, Bore Umanig Lechola Bruim. One of them has a pasuk, which is that Animamin Bemuna Shlema, Shaboris Barashimu, Yodea Kol Maasei Bnei Odom, Lechol Machshavosom, Sheneemar, Hayotzer Yachad Libam, Hamevino Kol Maaseihim. Why would that one have to bring a pasuk? Because the next one says, "An imam in bemuna shleima, shabore yisbarach shemo, gomel tov l'shomri mitzvosov, uman yishla obri mitzvosov." God punishes wicked people and rewards righteous people. That implies that people have free choice. Because if they don't have free choice, there's no reason to reward people for doing good or punishing them for doing bad if they're forced to do it. They have to have free choice to be able to get reward and punishment. Now, if they have free choice, how in the world could God know what's going to be? And if God knows, how could they have free choice? These two things are contradictory. Now, that people have free choice and there's reward and punishment, you don't need any psukim. The whole Torah is full of that. That's what the Torah is all about. Do this, you get rewarded. Do this, you get punished. So you don't need a pasuk to tell me that. But maybe it's not true that God knows everything. So therefore, I need a pasuk to tell me, even though the next one's going to tell you that people have free choice, you should know that God knows everything. And there's a pasuk that says it. Hayotzer yachad libam, hamevino kol maaseihim. But don't think there's a contradiction. So in any case. So God's knowledge doesn't necessarily affect free choice. But if it's already written somewhere in the Torah, the Torah exists, the script exists, not just in God's mind, then how could there be free choice? It says what Adam's going to do. It says what Paro's going to do. It says what Sodom is going to do. It's all there. So when did they have a choice to do it? They're just following a script. It's like the following joke. There was a, we won't make it an ethnic joke, even though I heard it as an ethnic joke. There was a smart man and a stupid man. And they went to see a cowboy movie where John Wayne was the star of the movie. And the smart man said to the dumb man, "I'll bet you $100 that John Wayne is going to fall off his horse in the middle of the movie." The dumb man said, "It's impossible. John Wayne never falls off his horse. I accept the bet." And sure enough, in the middle of the movie, John Wayne falls off his horse. They come out of the movie and they... dumb guy takes out his $100 and he's ready to give it to the smart guy. And the smart guy says, "I can't take your money." He says, "Why not?" He says, "Because I saw the movie before. I knew that John Wayne is going to fall off his horse." And the dumb guy says, "I also saw the movie before, but I couldn't believe that John Wayne would fall off his horse twice." If the movie's already written, if the script is already there, it's going to happen. It can't happen differently. So if the Torah was written before the world, then how does anybody have free choice? The answer is, says the Ramban, the Torah wasn't written as we know it. The Torah before the world was created with the combinations of God's name. It was written all jumbled, not the way we see the letters now. It was written where the letters themselves were disjointed. Letters are made of many letters. An aleph is a vav, and a yud. Those letters were jumbled. And they all were different names of God. And God created the world with those names. Those are midos of Hashem. And those are what are the building blocks of the world. And that is the lifeblood of the world, the Torah. How the Torah, the letters assembled was how things happen in the world. Could have assembled differently. But it's all the same names of God, except the way we see it is that those letters of names of God assembled into the words and sentences that we know. But that happened as it happened. It could have assembled differently. But it all was there to begin with, but jumbled. Jumbled in such a way that it was just a jumble of names of God that formed the entire essence of what the Torah was. Says the Vilna Gaon, that's called dema. The word dema can mean a tear, but it has another meaning. Dema means a mixture. If you have truma that falls into regular grain, that's called dimua, dema, mixture, gets mixed up. That's what it means. God dictated those last eight sentences to Moshe, but not in the words that we have them, the dema. He dictated them jumbled. So Moshe really didn't know what the words were. They were just jumbled letters of God's names. And later, after Moshe died, those letters were assembled into the words we have speaking about Moshe's death. Just like the rest of the Torah was like that before the world was created and before the things actually happened. They only assembled themselves, organized themselves as the things happened. And that's the way God dictated the Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu. But the last eight sentences, he dictated bedema in a total mixture, in a jumble, and it didn't say yet what it says the way we have it. It was a jumble of letters that were just names of God that, after Moshe died, were assembled into the words and sentences that we have. If that's the case, you can understand the following. It says in the end of Hazinu, Ki lo dover reiku mikem. The Torah is not something empty. And if you consider it empty, if you think it's empty, mikem, it's your fault. You don't really understand it. Because there's not a word or letter in the Torah that is not significant. There's nothing in the Torah that's just there because of information or because of scientific information or historical information. It may look like that. But every single letter that's in the Torah, every part of every letter, is somehow a part of God's name that went into the building blocks of creation. And the Torah is the building block of creation. It is the foundation of life. Ki hi chayechem. All life, all existence was created by God willing it into creation with various names of his, meaning various midos, various attributes of him. And every part of the world was created with a different attribute, and the source of that attribute is in the Torah. And therefore every letter and every word in the Torah is somehow linked to the entire existence of all the worlds. And every time you learn the Torah, you are giving life to the world. It keeps the world going. That's why it says, if it wouldn't be for the Torah, the world couldn't exist. And if for one second no one was learning Torah, the world would cease to exist. The Torah is the energy source of all the worlds, because the letters that make up the Torah are the building blocks of all the worlds. And it's not a one-time thing, and the Torah just records it. But it's an ongoing creation, and the source of it is the letters of the Torah. So every time you learn those letters, you are energizing the world. And if no one would learn Torah, then the energy source of the world would cease, and the world would stop existing. So Torah is not a dover reik. It's not an empty thing. There's nothing in the Torah that's empty. And if it appears that way, it's mikam, because you don't understand it. Because if you'd really understand the depth of every letter in the Torah, you would see that they are the building blocks of creation. Which brings us to another pasuk in the beginning of Hazinu. Kishem Hashem Ekra, Havu Golda Lalokeinu. when I call the name of God, you give greatness to God. From here is one of the sources of Birchas HaTorah. From here we learn, according to some opinions, that you have to make a bracha before you learn Torah. Now, where is there a hint over here to learning Torah? It says, Kishem Hashem Ekra, when I call out the name of God, you give praise, you give greatness, meaning make a bracha. But where does learning Torah have to do it? But like we said, Torah is the names of God. All the Torah is merely building blocks of creation, which are the names of God. The way that they assembled themselves is the way that God dictated it to Moshe Rabbeinu, is after the fact. But before the fact, before things happened, these were the building blocks of creation. They could have assembled themselves many ways. As things happened, they assembled themselves the way that they were. God assembled them the way they were. But they all were there from before. Hold on one second. And therefore, the Torah is the names of God. So when it says, Kishem Hashem Ekra, means when I tell you Torah, make a bracha. You're making the bracha on the essence of Torah. That Torah is the life of all the worlds. It's the life of every Jew. It is the foundation of the world. And that's what you make the bracha on, which answers another question. Women make a Birchas HaTorah in the morning. You are not chayiv in Birchas HaTorah. So the Ashkenazim amongst you have no problem with that, because you're not chayiv in the mitzvah of shofar either, nor the mitzvah of lulav, nor the mitzvah of sukkah. But if you want to do it, and you want to fulfill it voluntarily, you make a bracha. You make a bracha on lulav, you make a bracha on sukkah, you make a bracha on shofar. That's according to Ashkenazim. But the Sfardim paskin like those opinions that say that you can do the mitzvah voluntarily, but you can't make a bracha. How can you make a bracha asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav etzivanu when God didn't command you? He didn't command you. You're doing it voluntarily. He didn't say you had to do it. A man has to do it. So you can make a bracha asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav etzivanu. But how does a woman make asher kiddushanu? So the Ashkenazim hold, like those poskim who say, that tzivanu means God, you commanded the Jewish people as a people. Some people have to do it. Some people can do it. But the command isn't a general command on the Jewish people. So women are included in that command too. They're not specifically commanded to have to do it, but they're part of the Jewish people, and the Jewish people were commanded. So they can say also Vitzivanu. But Sfardim don't hold like that. They hold that, how can you say Vitzivanu if you're not commanded? So a Sfardish woman can do the mitzvah, she doesn't make any bracha. Not allowed to make a bracha. So for Ashkenazim, we could say, okay, a woman doesn't have to learn Torah. But if she chooses to, then she has to make a, she can make a bracha if she wants, and she can say, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav etzivanu lasok b'divrei Torah. But that doesn't answer for a Sephardi woman. Because a Sephardi woman, even if she does the mitzvah voluntarily, doesn't make a bracha on it. So why should make, and Sephardi women also make Birchas HaTorah. The Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef, Sephardi, says you make a birch, women make Birchas HaTorah. So there's an answer that women also have parts of Torah they have to learn. The halachas, mitzvahs, right? Every mitzvah a woman has to do, she has to learn the halachas of it. She has to know them. So she has a chiyuv to learn, not als Torah, but als mitzvahs. But according to this, it's a different idea. The bracha on learning Torah is not a bracha on the mitzvah of learning Torah. Even though it sounds like that, asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav etzivanu lasok b'divrei Torah, but it's not the bracha on the mitzvah of learning Torah. It's the bracha on the essence of what Torah is. We are thanking the Rabbanu Shalom. It's a bracha of Shevach v'Hodah. I thank the Rabbanu Shalom that he gave us the source of all existence. And it says that in Pirkei Avos. We are special, right? Chavivim Yisrael. Shenitn lohem kli chemda, shenivru bo shemayim v'aretz. We were given that tool which God used to create heaven and earth, which is the Torah. And that was given equally to men and women. Women may not have a mitzvah to learn Torah, but they were given that tool. They have the same life force in Torah that men have. They may not have a mitzvah to learn it all the time, but they definitely have the Torah. Torah was given to women too. So the bracha is not on the mitzvah of learning Torah. It's on a shevach v'hodah to Hashem that we have that schus of being the ones who are entrusted with the Torah, which is the foundation of the entire world. That's one way of understanding. There's another way. I'm going to finish this and I'll take the question. There's another way of understanding it. There's another source for Birchas HaTorah. The source is from Birchas HaMazon. Birchas HaMazon, it says in the Torah, eat, bench. Now, if on physical food you have to make a bracha, surely on spiritual food you have to make a bracha. Right? The only problem is, benching is after you eat. The bracha we make on the Torah is before you learn Torah. So if we learn it from benching, after you learn some Torah, you should make a bracha on it. But the obvious answer is there's a difference between physical food and spiritual food. Physical food, when do you need to make that bracha? When you're full, right, you've eaten, then you need to acknowledge that God is the one who gave you that food and that you still need him, even though you're full and now you think you don't need God anymore. When you're hungry, you know you need God. You don't have to make any brachas. That's only rabbinic. But when you're full, then there's always a chance you'll forget the Rabban Hashem. I don't need him anymore. I'm full. So after you eat, acknowledge the fact that you still need God. Thank him for the food. When it comes to Torah, it's just the opposite. When you've learned Torah, you're inspired. You know that there's a Rabban Hashem. The problem is before you learn Torah, whether you're going to be inspired. So make the bracha before you learn Torah. In addition, you never stop learning Torah. Food, you finish a meal. But Torah is something you never get filled up with. It's a spiritual thing. So therefore, you can't make the bracha when you finish, because you never really finish. So you make the bracha when you start daily, when you start that day. And therefore, since the bracha is like Birchas HaNehemim, just like you make a bracha on physical food, you make a bracha on spiritual food, even though a woman doesn't have a mitzvah to learn Torah, but the Torah for her is spiritual food, and if she learns it, she's eating spiritual food. She has to make a bracha. You don't have to eat either. But if you eat, you make a bracha. You don't have to learn Torah, but if you learn, you have to make a bracha. It's a bracha, birchas hanehenin. So it's possible that the bracha on Torah is not a birchas hamitzvah, which would then say that women, if you don't make a bracha on other mitzvahs, shouldn't make one on this. It's a birchas, either a birchas hanehenin. It's a bracha of enjoyment, like benching. Or it's a birchas shevach v'hodah. It's a bracha of giving praise to the Rabbanu Shel Olam for the schus that we have of being the ones who received that those building blocks that God used in creating the world. Okay, now, yeah.
I was just wondering, like, about the concept that without the Torah, the world would cease to exist. Can Hashem keep the world going? What it sounds like the Torah is the boss over Hashem.
No. It's, let's say that somebody designed a machine. And the machine needs to be recharged constantly. Otherwise the battery will run out. Okay? Now the person who designed the machine designed it to run on that battery because that's how it works. Okay? It could be even that he wants the machine to work only as long as that battery keeps it going, because without that battery there's no purpose for the machine. The machine is dangerous and if that battery is not part of it, okay? The battery is the Torah. The recharging is learning Torah. The more we learn Torah, the more we recharge the battery. If the battery stops, God, to keep the world going, there's no purpose to it. Because without that battery, the world is not a productive or even safe place or whatever it could be. So therefore, if it would be possible, I once said this over Shavuos at my table, my Yontif table, many, many years ago, when one of my daughters, who is now a mother of children of that age herself, was about, I don't know how old she was, maybe 8 years old at the time. Now she has daughters who are twice that age. So she, of all my children, she was the one who sustained for my drushes. And she would listen, and she would come to me afterwards and say, Tati, that was a great question, but I have a better answer. And she usually did have a better answer. In any case, so I remember one Shavuos, we were talking about this idea, and she said, now I understand what we learn in social studies. that when it's light on one side of the world, it's dark on the other side of the world. Because if it would be light and all the world at the same time and dark all the same time, then everybody would sleep at the same time and it would be possible nobody's learning Torah. And the world couldn't exist. So God made it that the world lives in shifts. When some people are sleeping, some people are up. So there's always the possibility of somebody learning Torah. In any case, so it may not seem like that. But that's the Metzias. The Chofetz Chaim says that there was once a marshal. There was once a very wealthy man who wanted to have the most expensive, luxurious yacht built for him. And he commissioned a builder and an architect to design the most luxurious yacht. And he told them like this: there can't be anything plain in this yacht. Anything plain, I'm not going to pay you a penny. Everything has to be luxurious. So make sure that you make everything luxurious or you don't get paid. So they designed this beautiful boat, and they brought the man to see it after it was finished to inspect it and get paid. So he said, remember, I told you, there's nothing, something that's not luxurious, you're not getting paid. They said, no, everything. So they took him on the boat, they took him to the staterooms, and they were wall-to-wall plush carpeting, the bathroom fixtures were gold, everything was luxurious. Took him to the ballrooms, same thing. Dining room, everything was mamish gold and carpeted and with hanging, beautiful. Finally, they took him down underneath, and he sees a room with a plain doorknob, and it looks like smoke coming out from under the door. Doesn't look like there's a carpet there. He says, I want you to open this door immediately. I have a feeling that what's behind that door is not luxurious. They open the door, and sure enough, there's soot all over the floor. There's no carpet. There's a plain doorknob. So he says, look, I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to give you 24 hours to take this room out of my boat, or you don't get paid. So they took the engine room out of the boat, and it sank. The engine room may not look as luxurious as the rest of the boat. Somebody sitting and learning Torah may not appear to be doing any great shakes as compared to doctors and lawyers and architects and builders or whatever, but the engine room may not look as luxurious as the rest of the boat, but it's what keeps the boat floating. That's the energy source of the boat. So may not appear like that, but that's the way l'maisa it is. There's another maisa with the Chofetz Chaim, that the Chofetz Chaim called a meeting of all the rich people in the area around Radin, and they were going to build a hospital for Jewish patients run by Jews after World War I, because the care that Jews got in the non-Jewish hospitals wasn't great, and there was a lot of need for people who were sick. So the Chofetz Chaim wanted to show how important this meeting was, so he called it in the Beis Medrash in the yeshiva in Raton, his yeshiva, to show that, you know, a meeting in a Beis Medrash, it must be pretty important. So all these rich people came, and the Chofetz Chaim got up, and he made an impassioned plea of how important this hospital is, and he asked for each person to get up and donate a certain amount of beds to the hospital. Each bed represented a certain amount of money. So this guy got up and donated 5 beds, another one 6 beds, 8 beds. Finally, the richest man got up. And he looks and he sees in the back of the Beis Medrash, there's this avreich, this guy sitting and learning. So he figures he's going to make a little joke. So he said, I will donate 5 times the amount of beds that man in the back donates. Everybody laughed because the guy in the back was obviously a poor Talmud Chacham, right, that couldn't donate maybe a pillowcase, let alone a bed. So everybody was laughing. The Chofetz Chaim got up livid, banged on his tender, and he said to this rich man, you couldn't donate 1,000th of what that man could donate. So everybody thought, wow, this guy's some kind of, you know, really rich guy that nobody knows about. He's 1,000 times richer than this man. Chofetz Chaim said, let me explain. What could you donate? 10 beds, 100 beds, 1,000 beds that the people in this area, sick people, could be taken care of? That man with his Torah could guarantee there won't be any sick people in this area. With all the money in the world, you can't guarantee that. With Torah, you can. So Torah doesn't only give the world existence, and if there's no Torah, there's no existence. But the more Torah, the more substantial the world is, the more settled it is, the more safe it is, and so on. That's the way. That's the Metzius. So therefore, on that, that we were entrusted with that, and women were entrusted with that as much as men. So that's what makes the bracha. It's a shevach v'hodah. It's also a birchas hanehenin, that when I learn Torah, I'm keeping my little world going too. It's not only the energy source of the microcosm, a macrocosm, it's the energy source of the microcosm too, of every little world, which is you and me. So it's a brachas hanehenin. I'm giving a bracha on my sustenance. So therefore, women make that bracha also. And that's where the hint is to the bracha, ki shem Hashem ekra, because the Torah is, in essence, names of God. Just arranged the way that we see it. But originally it was jumbled up names of God that were basically the building blocks of creation. Okay, and it's been too much time for that. But in any case, but let me tell you one more thing then, which is in Hazinu, that based on this you can understand better. It says, Tzur Yilad Choteshi. The meaning is, you have weakened God. In plain terms, you have weakened God. Now that sounds pretty wild. We weakened God. But I'll tell you something even more wild that we say every day in davening. Maybe you never noticed it. Tenu oz lelokim. What does it mean? Give strength to God. I got enough problem myself. I give God strength. But that's what it says. We give strength to God. So you can weaken God, and you can make God strong. Sounds pretty idolatrous to me. Right? We can strengthen God, we can weaken him. What does that mean? The answer is that God made a world that is powered by Torah. Torah is mitzvahs, chesed, all the things that go into the Torah is the battery, is the energy that keeps the world going. And Elohim is God's name as he is the God of nature. Because Elohim in Gematria is Hateva, nature. God in nature, God in the world is called Elohim. That's why it's the plural. He is the power, the master of all powers that we see as powers of nature. And God invested the power in nature, in the world, in Torah. Torah, mitzvahs, davening, all the things that go into Torah. And he said, you know where the power is going to come from? Not from me. I set up the battery pack. But you know who charges those batteries? The Jewish people. Through Torah, mitzvahs, davening, chesed. Those are the things that charge the batteries on an ongoing basis. If you charge the batteries, then you make that world that I created in my image, right, strong. So you're strengthening me, Kibiyachol, as the creator of the world, as the guider of all nature. If you don't do those things, or you do things that make the batteries short circuit, right, the opposite of charging the batteries, of discharging the batteries with averas, with the opposite of chesed, with the opposite of Torah, Lashon Hara is the opposite of Torah, then you are discharging the battery and you're weakening me. You're weakening my connection to the world. Because I made the connection to the world through this energy source. If you make the energy source stronger, then you're strengthening my connection to the world. If not, you're weakening my connection. So you're basically giving power, lelokim, to God in nature, or you're taking away that power from God in nature. That's called tzur. God is the rock. He is the foundation of all nature. So that's how we can give power to the Ribbono Shel Olam or take away that power. And that's God's will. He wants the world to be run by us. We're the ones who put in the energy source. Okay, let's do the last thing in the Torah. Torah, the Ribbono Shel Olam felt it, the way to finish the Torah, the Siyum, is Le'enei Kol Yisrael, Kol Hayada Chazok Asher Osa Moshe Le'enei Kol Yisrael. What was that? That he broke the Luchos. That was the peak of Moshe Rabbeinu's career. Not that he got the Torah, not that he took us out of Mitzrayim, not that he split the Red Sea. All those things were, yeah, they were nice. But you know what Moshe really did? He broke the luchos. Le'enei kol Yisrael. Why in the world would the Torah end with that, and that like that is the peak of Moshe Rabbeinu's career? He broke the luchos le'enei kol Yisrael. And there's a connection between that and the beginning of the Torah. Le'enei kol Yisrael, Bereishis bo'er Elokim, and the Lamed of Yisrael and the Beis of Bereishis make Lev, heart. The Torah ends with a Lamed, starts with a Beis, Lev, heart. One idea is the following. The world was created, again, because of the Torah. Torah is the foundation and the energy source of the world. The Jewish people were entrusted with learning, developing that Torah, and guarding it, passing it on. So the world was created b'shvil ha-Torah, b'reishis, b'shvil Yisrael sh'nikroi reishis, u'b'shvil ha-Torah sh'nikroi reishis. The world was created for the sake of the Torah and for the sake of the Jewish people who were entrusted with that Torah. Okay. And the Torah was meant to be given to Klal Yisrael in order to use it to develop the world. Now, therefore, the Torah is basically part and parcel of life. It's not just something that we do, that we know. It's not a separate thing. It's the essence of what we are. And that is the difference between Torah and Chochmah. Okay? The Gemara says, if someone tells you that there's Chochmah by the nations of the world, believe them. But if somebody tells you there's Torah by the nations of the world, don't believe them. There can't be Torah by the nations of the world. Now, literally, that doesn't make any sense. Because if it means that Goyim aren't allowed to learn Torah, so if somebody tells you Goyim learn Torah, don't believe it, because Goyim never do things they're not allowed to do, that's a little absurd, right? And there are plenty of Goyim who learn Torah. There's even Goyim who wrote Perushim on the Mishnah. And they're good Perushim. Danby was a priest. He wrote a Perush on the Mishnah. So, Goyim do learn Torah. Whether they're allowed to or not is a different story. Elamai, you're going to tell me that a Goy can't understand Torah? That's absurd. I'm sure a nuclear physicist could open an Art Scroll Chumash and make heads and tails of what it says there. And I'm telling you that they're Goyim who wrote commentaries on the Torah. So what does it mean? Torah by Goyim al tamin. It can't mean that a Goy isn't allowed to do it and therefore he doesn't do it, because he obviously does do it. And it can't mean that he can't do it, because he obviously does it. So what does it mean? So I think it means the following. Bertram Russell was a professor of ethics in City College in New York in the 1940s. Okay? About, 80 years ago. 90 years ago. And he was a professor of ethics, and during that period of his life, he was a very unethical person. He was a manuvel. He was not a moral person for many reasons. He was a communist, and he was a devotee of free love. He didn't believe in marriage, and he had a lot of things about him that for that time, the Goyim still had some, there were some morals in the world. So he was immoral, according to the Goyish standard. So the ethics committee of the college called him in, and they said, Professor Russell, we have a problem with you. You teach ethics in our institution, and you're not ethical. How do you resolve that contradiction? He said, what's the problem? He said, you know, 20 years ago, I taught mathematics in a college in England, and I happened to teach geometry. Not once did the ethics committee of that college call me in and say, Professor Russell, we have a problem with you. You teach geometry in our institution, and you're not a square, a circle, or a parallelogram. I don't have to be what I teach. I just have to teach it. I don't have to be ethical to teach ethics. I don't have to be a plane to teach geometry. That's Chochmah. Chochmah is something you possess. You can do what you want with it. It doesn't necessarily have to change. It can. There definitely were fine Goyim and Jews who had secular knowledge, and it made them better people. But it didn't have to. They would have been the same Chachamim, whether it changed them or not. There are many authors in literature all over the world, okay, especially literature, who were the most despicable people you can imagine. I mean, one author, an American author, who I won't mention his name, since this is a shul, the not so far in the past, a great author, wrote many, many very famous books, but he was a beach bum. Most of his life he was drunk, and if you tripped over him, you couldn't tell the difference between him and the beach bum next to him. But when he was sober, he wrote very good books. So his lifestyle did not detract one bit from his wisdom, his literary wisdom. And his literary wisdom didn't add one bit to his lifestyle. Two separate worlds. And we make a bracha on a chacham, mechachmei umas ha'olam, or a Jew who has secular knowledge. Asher nosan mechachmaso lebosar v'adam. You remain flesh and blood, and God gives you the wisdom, do what you want with it. Torah is not like that. Torah has to make an impression on you, or it's not Torah. Torah means to teach, to guide. Torah is compared to fire, the Gemara says. Fire makes an impression, Torah has to make an impression. And if it doesn't make an impression, it's not Torah. Then it remains chachma. You can learn Torah, and it looks like Torah, smells like Torah, sounds like Torah, but if it doesn't make an impression on you and change your life, make you a different person, at least minimally, doesn't have some effect on you, then it's not Torah. Because Torah is like fire. You know there's something called stage fire? Looks like fire, smells like fire, sounds like fire, but it's not real fire, right? It's artificial fire. How do you know it's artificial? It doesn't burn anything. But it looks like fire, smells like fire, tastes like fire, whatever, right? Sounds like fire, but it's fake because it doesn't burn anything. You can have Torah that looks like Torah, sounds like Torah, smells like Torah, but if it doesn't make an impression on the person who learns it, it's not Torah. It remains chachma. That's what it means. Goyim understand the concept of chachma. Wisdom does not necessarily have to make an impression on you. It can, but it doesn't necessarily have to. They don't understand the concept that in order for something to be Torah, it must make an impression. And if it doesn't, it's not Torah. It remains chachma. Yes? Yes and no. If it means that if you learn it and you totally ignore it, right? It doesn't have to make an impression on you right now. But it's something that at least that's what you want. There were people who learned Torah who were Mechallel Shabbos, who wrote their Chiddushei Torah smoking cigars on Shabbos. That's what it means. If you're not doing that, then some impression it makes. You want it to make an impression. It may not make it today, I'll make it tomorrow. But you may not see it today. But that's your intention. Even mitosha lo lishma ba lishma. But if you never want to get to lishma, you just want to utilize the Torah as mental gymnastics, as information, knowledge, but it has no connection to anything that you will ever do or embody, then it's not Torah. Then it's chacham. So in any case, so therefore, why did Moshe Rabbeinu break the Luchos? Right? He was entrusted to give the Torah to the Jewish people. Okay? And they were worshiping an eagle. It says the Kotzker Rebbe, Moshe was afraid that if he didn't break the Luchos, the Jewish people would take the Luchos and dance around the eagle with them and think that you can have Torah and you can have an eagle too. They're compatible. And Torah is just something that you have. And it doesn't necessarily have to make any impression or change your lifestyle. You could dance around an eagle with the Luchos too. So he broke them. And he said that you're not going to get them unless you deserve them and it's going to make an impression on you. You can't take the Luchos and have the eagle too. First we get rid of the eagle, then we give back the Luchos. And that's what happened on Yom Kippur. So Yom Kippur, we remind ourselves that if you want the Torah, you have to deserve it and you have to be the kind of person who embodies the Torah. So we do tshuva on Yom Kippur from all the things that make us not represent the Torah. So the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu broke the Luchos is he taught us with that the world was created for us, the world was created for the Torah, and they go together, and it's not just something we possess, it's our life, it's our very essence. And if you can't have that, then you can't have the Torah. So, Bereishis, Bar, Elokim, Eshashamayim, Eshaaretz, the purpose for creation was for the Torah, and the Mela for the Jewish people follows La'inei Kol Yisrael, that Moshe broke the Luchos, La'inei Kol Yisrael, because there's no purpose in the Torah if you're not going to embody it. And if you're worshiping an eagle, you're not embodying it. So then you don't need it. Then we'll just break it. There's no purpose for it. It's worthless. I'll give it back to the Ribbono Shel Olam. It was made for you. It wasn't made just to be in a museum or to have carry around and dance around an eagle with it. So that was the most important lesson that Moshe Rabbeinu taught the Jewish people. And he broke the Luchos, La'inei Kol Yisrael, and that is the foundation of Bereishis, Bara Elokim, Shemayim V'Zoharis. That's the connection between the end of the Torah and the beginning of the Torah. Okay. In any case, I wish you all a Gemar Chasima Tova. I don't think we have class next week. You have some special tachnit? What? You're going to, okay, so you're surely not going to be there with me. I can't walk upstairs. I'm not going to walk up to Masada. Okay, so in any case, so I wish you all a Gemara Chasima Tova and a good Yom Tov, and I will see you, Amir Sashem, after Sukkot.